Hello, I'm Peter Callahan. This is number 0468, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0468. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, author and psychotherapist Dennis Palumbo talks about getting into a writer's head.
Whenever I, as a screenwriter, used to get good notes that I thought really would improve the screenplay, I used to get depressed because I knew if I really want this script to be good, I have to pay attention to them. Whereas if you got bad notes, if somebody said, well, gee, can't we make the woman a hooker? Everyone likes to look at hookers. Then I would say to myself, okay, I'll just ignore this note. But when you get a good note and you really care about the work you're doing, you can't ignore it. And that often means something that you've worked on a long time and that you feel is finished. You have to then deconstruct and go back to work on.
Ernie Smith from the newsletter Tedium talks about the history of the disposable camera, which goes back further than you may think.
There was an example of a disposable camera from the late 19th century called the Ready Photographer. It was made of cardboard and paper and a little piece of glass, and it could only take one photo. It would only allow for one exposure. It was really ahead of its time, but it was out there. It existed. It doesn't look anything like what we think of as disposable cameras now.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and on Book Banter, I look at the life of the last black unicorn. Well, actually, comic Tiffany Haddish. This is no fantasy, and it's coming up soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news, and of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0468 was actor Peter Callahan. You can see him as Myers on Murdoch Mysteries and Richard on Working Moms, both on the CBC. And if you find yourself in St. Catharines, Ontario this month, check him out in his first stage play in decades called Renovations for Six. It's at the Foster Festival. And you'll find links to the Foster Festival website by going to my website at thestufffile.com. Just look for the show number, which Peter just mentioned. See how it all goes full circle? And you'll find the link to the Foster Festival website. By the way, I've known Peter since college days, and I think everyone who knew him back then, we all knew he was going to be a star. And even though I've known him for a long time, it was years before I realized that the G was silent. Anyway, thank you very much, Peter, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? The Nash County Sheriff's Office of North Carolina said a man managed to steal $100 worth of steaks from a Walmart in Nashville by stuffing them down his pants. They even posted a picture of the meat. The man then fled the scene on a moped. Okay, let's stop here for a moment. Sure, the price of meat has been going up lately, but even still, fitting $100 worth of steaks down your pants has got to be uncomfortable. Anyway, the guy made his getaway on a moped in the pouring rain. When deputies pulled him over, they found at least 10 packages of steak stuffed down the man's pants. The sheriff's office posted a photo of the steaks laid out on the hood of the deputy's cruiser, along with photos of the arrest. You know, there is a kind of sad poetry to this scene. A man alone on his moped in the rain with 10 steaks in his pants. The sheriff's office did not identify the man and didn't say what was done with the recovered steaks. At that point, you might as well let him keep the meat. I mean, nobody else is going to want to eat it. Nobody wants a lot of felt-up filet, if you know what I mean. A man who was charged with murder for killing his girlfriend with his manhood will walk free. Yeah, you heard me right. If you're thinking that he used it as a club, just let me get to the story, okay? 65-year-old Richard Henry Patterson of Florida was charged with second-degree murder after his girlfriend died while they were having sex. Patterson claimed that 60-year-old Francesca Marquinez died after accidentally choking on his manhood. An autopsy confirmed that Marquinez died of asphyxiation after she choked on Patterson's privates. It was also determined that there was no sign of a struggle. Patterson's attorney asked the judge to allow the jury to see his client's manhood, but the judge declined. That would have been a first in American jurisprudence. After hearing the case, the jury determined that the death was an accident, and Patterson was found not guilty. Can you imagine the written obituary for this poor woman? Well, I guess they could always say that she died of a nut allergy. The Swedes don't like to waste opportunities. When a heavy storm flooded a train station, some of the local residents turned the platforms into a makeshift water park. Several people posted pictures on social media of bathers bobbing along the submerged tracks on inflatables while wearing flippers and swim masks. Some people questioned the safety of the operation, remarking that bathers could possibly be at risk or disease or of being electrocuted. But another described the bathers as absolute legends. Unfortunately, the party ended pretty quickly, with the emergency services hastily pumping the water from the station and returning it to normal. Could you imagine if this happened in a New York subway station? You'd have swimmers battling for space among the synchronized swimming rats. Anyway, here's a quote. "I believe this is a miracle." That's a quote from a parishioner at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church in Hobbs, New Mexico, after its statue of the Virgin Mary appeared to be shedding tears, bringing crowds of visitors. "Not so fast," said the Diocese of Las Cruces. "Miracles have to be investigated." A sample of the liquid streaming down the statue's face was collected. "We determined it was olive oil. A scented olive oil," says Bishop Oscar Cantu. "Something similar to the oil I bless and consecrate each year that we use for baptism, for confirmations, and for ordination of the priests." Well, I'm guessing, you know, since it was rolling down the cheeks of the statue, that it must be extra virgin olive oil. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 25-year-old Robert Quigley was cruising at 75 to 80 miles per hour on Interstate 80 in Citrus Heights, California, and apparently didn't notice traffic in front of him had stopped. He slammed into an SUV, and his car burst into flames. Quigley escaped uninjured, but he went back to his burning car. "Yeah, I'm not afraid of fire," he told a highway patrol officer who responded to the crash. "I deal with this kind of stuff all the time." The trooper noticed Quigley's eyebrows were singed. And what was so important that Quigley needed to go back to his flaming car? He wanted to lean in to light a cigarette. He was arrested on a charge of drunk driving, his second such charge in a week. He said he deals with this kind of stuff all the time. Yeah, that's because his entire life seems to be a flaming wreck. He's drunk, so he can't be the idiot of the day, but damn, that really is stupid. Wow. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? We often talk to thriller writer Dennis Palumbo. We last spoke to him at the beginning of July about his latest Daniel Rinaldi mystery entitled Head Wounds. But Dennis is also a licensed psychotherapist and a former Hollywood screenwriter. So I thought we'd have him back on the show to share some information from his other profession and talk about getting into a writer's head. Dennis joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing?
Just tickety-boo. You recently wrote an article in Suspense Magazine for their summer issue entitled "What's So Bad About Good Notes?" And you're talking about the idea of getting notes from an editor, or if you're a screenwriter like you were, getting notes from producers and directors. And I thought it would be an opportunity to talk about what you do also as a psychotherapist, because you work with a lot of people who are writers in your profession, having known that side of the world as well. So let's talk about the situation of getting bad notes or good notes.
First of all, you have to define your terms. You know,
yeah.
One of the things I tried to do in the article is differentiate between, let's say, you are a writer and your editor gives you a note that will make everything really much better, make the story much better, make us care more about the characters. But you've spent 2 years working on this novel, and the thought that you're going to now deconstruct all of this and add in all of these changes can be very disheartening. You know, whenever I, as a screenwriter, used to get good notes, notes that I thought really would improve the screenplay, I used to get depressed because I knew, gosh, if I really want this script to be good, I have to pay attention to them. Whereas if you got bad notes, if somebody said, well, gee, can't we make the woman a hooker? Everyone likes to look at hookers. Then I would say to myself, okay, I'll just ignore this note or I'll fight back on it. But when you get a good note and you really care about the work you're doing, you can't ignore it. You have to do it. And that often means something that you've worked on a long time and that you feel is finished, you have to then deconstruct and go back to work on. For a writer, the other problem with a good note is, depending on your level of confidence, you can say to yourself, why didn't I think of that? I'm the writer here. I should have thought of that. Maybe I'm not as good a writer as I think I am. You know, the thing about anyone handing their material to someone else to read is you are instantly opening yourself up for evaluation. Many, many people are terrified at the thought that their work is going to be criticized because the work represents them.
Now, in the situation, and you've had both situations, as I said, you're a screenwriter, you're a novelist. Is there a difference? And the reason why I ask that question is, as a screenwriter, even though the work can be personal, you're more or less a hired gun. As a novelist, everything hinges on your name, basically. It's a book written by you. It's your thoughts. It's your name that's out there. Is it different when you get notes as a writer as opposed to get notes as a screenwriter?
Oh, it's very, very different. As a screenwriter, you are a writer for hire. In fact, if anybody ever watches at the end of a film, it'll say, let's say the film is from, you know, Sony, it'll say screenplay, copyright by Sony. You don't even own the material as a screenwriter. And so as a result, you are a writer for hire. If they ask you to do something, to change something, and you don't do it, you just get fired, and they hire another writer, which is why you'll see often two or three names listed as written by on a film. They weren't all together in a room writing it. One of them was writing it and then didn't want to do what the changes were suggested, and they got fired. And so another writer was hired. As opposed to now, as a novelist, my editor will make suggestions. And I have a good editor at Poison Pen Press, so the suggestions are usually good, and I'm happy to take them. But every time she makes them, she always says, now, of course, this is your book, so you don't have to do that if you don't want to.
Mm. Now,
see, if you write a book, it's copyright Dennis Palumbo.
Right.
Because it's mine. I own it.
Right.
Whereas if you write screenplays, you don't own it.
As the story you wrote for Suspense Magazine stipulates, when you get notes and you change something inside because of those notes can have a domino effect on other parts of the story, which you will then have to change.
That's right. Let's say you finish your screenplay and the producer or the director says, well, how about instead of it being a girlfriend, why don't we make the woman his sister? Well, you as the writer go, yeah, I know what they're thinking. And they're thinking about it in terms of this one scene or this other scene. But I as the writer knows that if you pull that thread, if you change her from girlfriend to sister, you're going to have to rewrite almost every other scene in this movie or it won't make any sense. because all the relationship dynamics change now. Right. And that's something that most producers and directors don't get, that when they make a suggestion, particularly if it's fairly major, if they make a suggestion like that, for the writer, that means you have to comb through the entire screenplay and make all sorts of adjustments to accommodate that note. And again, it can be very debilitating on a writer's sense of agency, on their sense of feeling collegial with this other person, because, as I said, if you're a screenwriter, you're their employee. And the thing that people don't understand is, even if this screenplay is your idea, you bring it to them and they buy it. The moment they buy it, it's not yours anymore.
Let's talk a little bit about your work. As you know, I'm a big, big fan of Daniel Rinaldi and the mystery series that you've written, the latest book being Head Wounds. You say you have an editor that you work with, and you've done now 5 of these books. I've enjoyed them all, but is there something inherently different in any one of them? And you don't have to go into great detail. Is there something inherently different in any one of them from what you originally wrote to what was finally put out?
No. I am very, very lucky and very, very grateful that my novels are 99.9% exactly what I want to have on the page. What makes my editor, I have 2 of them actually, at Poison Prince so good is they know the character of Daniel Rinaldi almost as well as I do. So they'll often say to me, are you sure Daniel would say that in that situation? Or maybe he could be a little more proactive in that scene. And in almost every case, I tend to agree with them. And the only place I think that I've benefited, I think, the most is because I'm a therapist and the books are in the first person, I'll often let Daniel Rinaldi, let's say, ruminate a lot about therapeutic practice. And once in a while, one of my editors will go, could we cut that back a little? Because remember, there is a guy out there trying to kill him. And so I often get a little carried away with some of that stuff, and I'm very grateful for when they rein me back in. But as I said before, they always say to me, but on the other hand, this is your book, and if you really want to do that, you know, go ahead and do it.
Now, as a psychotherapist, and I know you can't delve into specifics because of the patient-client privilege, but generally speaking, when you hear stories, because a lot of the people you work with are writers, when you hear stories that they might come to you with, do you get a sense that you're hearing just one side of the story and it's really a horror story, or is it really a horror story?
Well, in my experience, because I was a screenwriter for so many years, and had so many horror stories visited upon me, I tend to believe what my patients tell me, because if they tell me about the kinds of notes they're getting that are making them feel very doubtful about themselves or insecure or angry or feel like the person they're working with doesn't really get what they're trying to do, I tend to take their side, not just because I'm a writer myself, but because I've been in the situation they're in. And in my experience, and I know I get a lot of flack for this, but I always say it, in my experience, the writer is the smartest person in the room. In that, they know more about the story they're trying to tell and the characters they're trying to portray than any of the execs or producers who are in that room do. If for no other reason, that when that meeting's over, those execs and producers are going to talk to another writer about another script. So no one is as deeply invested or has dived as deeply into it as the person doing the writing. And so I have a bias. I tend to be pro-writer. And I guess if I broaden it out, I tend to be pro-my patients. I believe what they tell me because there's no other way for us to work together.
And writers by I think writers by nature are solitary creatures, and maybe solitary creatures because I think it's too strong to say don't play well with others, but there is a sense of that a little bit. So when they get pushback, it might affect them more than the average person who gets pushback, who's more sociable, I guess is the term I'm looking for.
Yeah, actually, that's very astute on your part. I think, in my experience, most writers don't play well with others. I mean, I always say to people, I'm not a team player when it comes to my writing. You know, my agent will often say, well, let's go have lunch and we'll spitball some ideas for a novel. And I always think that's like the worst thing I'd ever heard of, and I would never do it. And so you're right. I think when we get notes, part of it is the pushback from we've been in our own little world, and we believe we know this little world better than anyone. So who are you to give me any pushback?
Yeah.
So I think you're right. I think that that's part of the what's woven into being a writer is the creation of your own world, which often you've done since you were a kid, by the way. And now, as a professional writer, you want to be able to stand behind that private world, and you don't want someone else telling you it would look a lot prettier if it was blue instead of green.
Is there a graveyard out there of ideas that you had cut from works you've done in the past where those thoughts and passages and ideas are dead and buried? Or is there an intensive care unit somewhere where those things are just lying in state kind of way, waiting to be resuscitated later on?
Well, as I always say, I think everything you write has a long shelf life. I wrote half of a novel 20 years ago that I never finished, but it had a really cool sequence in the middle of it. And I ended up using that sequence in slightly altered form in the second Daniel Rinaldi novel, Fever Dream. So I think that everything you write should be saved somewhere, and you end up using it in a way that maybe you hadn't initially intended. But like I said, I think good writing has a long shelf life. Even if it's not appropriate on the project you're working on now, don't throw it away. In some other form, it could fit really well into some project you're going to do in the future.
Good advice. And Dennis, always a pleasure to talk to you and share some of your expertise and also share some of the books that you've written.
Thank you, Peter. As I always say at the end of one of these, people who are interested in my work can go to my website, DennisPalumbo.com.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
Thank you, Peter.
Dennis Palumbo, author of Head Wounds. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page for this show, which is show number 0468, and you'll find links to Dennis's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You'll also find the link to the article he wrote for the summer edition of Suspense Magazine. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about disposable cameras, plus Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter. We have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, plus much more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Police say an Arkansas man accused of trying to steal a commercial jet told investigators he thought piloting a plane would involve little more than pushing buttons and pulling levers. Investigators say 18-year-old Zamarcus Devin Scott wanted to fly to an out-of-state concert when he hopped inside an American Eagle jet at Texarkana Regional Airport. Scott was inside the cockpit when he was arrested early on July 4th. He was charged and jailed on commercial burglary and attempted theft of property charges. It was not reported what musical act Scott thought it was worth stealing a jet to go and see. Please tell me it wasn't Kenny G or Zamfir. What I'd like to know is exactly where he was planning to land. You know, I'm willing to bet this 18-year-old moron has probably spent way too much time playing flight simulator video games. Arizona authorities say a 44-year-old uniformed security guard is accused of impersonating a police officer by trying to pull over an unmarked car that happened to contain two state troopers patrolling a Phoenix freeway. The Department of Public Safety said Matthew Allen Disbro of Mesa was driving his personal black Dodge Charger when he activated law enforcement-style emergency lights on his car to pull over the trooper's yellow Ford Mustang. According to the department, the troopers wouldn't pull over. Disbro then drove alongside, yelled and waved a hand at the troopers to get them to pull over before they activated their own vehicle's police lights and pulled him over. Oh, the irony of the troopers turning on their police lights is just too delicious. Although Disbro isn't the idiot of the day, he has to feel pretty stupid right about now. On July 17th, RV park neighbors and longtime adversaries Ryan Felton Sauter and Keith Monroe got into a heated dispute about an undisclosed subject. Later that day, Monroe saw Sauter leaving Monroe's RV and asked him why he had gone in without permission, to which Sauter replied, "You'll see why." Going inside, Monroe soon spotted a 3-foot-long rattlesnake. "I freaked out," he said. He used a machete to kill the snake, which strangely was missing its rattles. Turns out Sauter had bitten off the snake's tail with its signature warning sound. Sauter has been charged with deadly conduct and criminal trespass. Now that's what you call revenge, Texas style. And by the way, do you really want to deal with someone who would bite the tail off of a rattlesnake? Seriously. Wow. 37-year-old Jeffrey Jacobs thought he had a great thing going. Last year, when a tree fell on his White Plains, New York home, he told the owner of the tree service, who was also a big hockey fan, that he was the owner of the NHL's Boston Bruins. Impressed, the tree service owner sent a crew in the midst of a storm, then billed the actual club owner, 78-year-old Jeremy Jacobs, not Jeffrey, but Jeremy Jacobs, $5,100 for the service. Police in nearby Wilton, Connecticut, heard about the deception when they received a call in May from security officials at a company chaired by the Bruins owner. The story sounded familiar. In November, Jacobs had been pulled over in Wilton, and he told officers he owned the Bruins in an effort to get out of the ticket. Well, on July 20th, Jacobs was pulled over for using his phone while driving in Poughkeepsie, New York. He was sent back to Wilton and charged with criminal impersonation. Oh, bingo. I wonder if he'll get one of the Bruins' lawyers to represent him.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
This is an important self-serving promotional bulletin. My book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars, is still available. And like the title says, within the pages you'll find some of my celebrity encounters with Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer. Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner. Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar. A host of TV icons, plus two guys who left their footprints on the moon. Order it now. It's available in hardcover, softcover, and for your e-reader on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website at BearManorMedia.com. All links are on our website at TheStuffFile.com. So, buy the book. What are you waiting for? This has been an important self-serving promotional bulletin.
I love you. Now, back to our show.
And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, just after midnight on July 22nd, a couple in Palo Alto, California, were awakened in their bedroom by a 17-year-old burglar with a garment obscuring his face. Instead of demanding money or jewelry, though, the intruder asked for their Wi-Fi password. The homeowner forced the teen out of the home and called police, who tracked him down a block away and arrested him for felony residential burglary. Police later determined it wasn't the teen's first attempt at connectivity. Less than an hour earlier that night, a prowler had summoned a woman from her home to ask for access to her Wi-Fi network also. She told him to go away and he rode off on a bicycle, which she realized the next day he had stolen from her backyard. She called police, who recovered the bike near where they had arrested the teen. Well, depending on where they send him to jail, he may be in luck. For the record, internet use is approved in 49 U.S. correctional systems and 5 Canadian provinces, but of course it's heavily supervised. Also, he won't be getting a bike. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Ernie Smith, the man behind the website and newsletter known as Tedium, which is subtitled The Dull Side of the Internet, is back. This time around, he's here to talk about a recent newsletter that takes a look at the disposable camera. Ernie joins us on the line via Skype from Virginia. Hi, Ernie.
Hey, how's it going?
Just tickety-boo. Nice to have you back on the show with us. Your recent newsletter is entitled Point, Shoot, and Forget. And I think the one thing that many of us forget is that, or maybe didn't even know, is that the disposable camera or the reusable camera is not something relatively new, not something that came out in the 80s or 90s, but you have to go way back to find the origins of it.
Yeah, well, you know, it technically did come out in the 80s, the 1880s. There was a example of a disposable camera from the late 19th century called the Ready Photographer. It was made of cardboard and paper and a little piece of glass, and it could only take one photo. It would only allow for, you know, one exposure, and it was really, you know, it was really ahead of its time. But it, you know, it was out there. It existed. And it doesn't look anything like what we think of as disposable cameras now.
And the thing that's interesting about it, if we go back, as you say, to the 1800s, let's talk a little, a few dollars. A typical camera, if you were to buy a real camera, was about $50. And this one you say is about what, 25 cents?
Yeah, it was very inexpensive for its time. I mean, obviously, you know, you have to keep in mind inflation and such, you know, just to kind of offer a point of comparison, the Kodak camera that also came out around the same time, the original Kodak camera, which actually was a returnable, in which that you would fill up the camera with the photos that you had taken and then mail it back to Kodak. You actually had to pay $10 to Kodak just to get your photos back. And $10 was no small chunk of change back in the late 19th century.
I could imagine. So going from that one in the late 19th century to something more recognizable to us as to what would be, again, not necessarily a disposable camera, but a returnable camera, what are we talking about? When was there a boom in that? I would assume one of the situations is that Kodak was the big bear in the market and other people were trying to do this and they never took them seriously until a larger competitor tried it.
Yeah, that was definitely the case. There were a number of examples of companies that tried to make the disposable camera a thing. There was one example from the 1940s called the PhotoPak, which you could buy for $1.50, and then you would mail the whole camera, literally put a stamp right on the camera, and send it. To them to get the film processed. Beyond that, in the 60s, there was an example of a patent that had been filed to create basically a disposable camera of sorts that essentially you could put like film that you bought from a store in, and then when you were done with it, you would throw the camera out and send the film to be processed. There were a number of other examples of this as well in the 70s. That seems to be when the competitors started to really pick up, but it didn't really turn a corner until the 80s when Fuji showed up on the scene.
Now, one of the things I understand is one of the things that helped make this grow is that it was not just the fact that you didn't have to carry a large bulky camera around with you and you didn't have to worry about always having your camera with you when you needed it, that the disposable cameras or the returnable cameras, one of their saving graces was that they're small. They could fit in your pocket.
Yes, it was definitely a situation where having a smaller and smaller size was of major benefit. Basically, the goal, even with disposable cameras that you can buy today, you can actually still purchase them on Amazon or, you know, if you get lucky at a drugstore, is that you can take the photos as you need them, but when you're done, it's really all about the photos. Like, it's not, you know, the camera gets out of the way. And I think that with a lot of examples of early cameras, such as the Plastic Development Corporation's plastic disposable camera, they were designed to be something that you could use and kind of get rid of when you were done with it.
Now, on paper, these sound like a good idea. On paper, what also sounds like a good idea are those disposable coffee pods that you put into those coffee makers for individual cups of coffee. But the downside of the coffee pods, and I would assume early cameras, was your carbon footprint, basically. You're returning something that in a lot of cases couldn't be reused, and people were concerned about environmental issues and littering.
Yes, there's actually an example at the time that Polaroid had released its instant film. There was a critic who had suggested that, you know, they thought that in response to that, Kodak would release a disposable camera, which it didn't for a few decades actually, but they had a major concern that, like, these disposable cameras would just show up all over the, you know, highways and byways of the U.S., just, you know, just leaving litter all over the place. But what's really interesting is that once these cameras, like, went mainstream in the late 80s and early 90s, Kodak in particular actually took steps to make them less disposable and more recyclable. The parts of a Kodak camera, you know, reusable, would actually be reused in other cameras. So essentially, if you were to buy a Kodak Funsaver at a store, it 10-to-1 would have been produced from the parts of old Funsaver cameras versus just kind of being made wholesale.
Was Fuji, their biggest competitor, were they also into the recyclables?
They weren't as aggressive about it, though. Literally, Kodak would take parts from its old cameras to come out with new models, whereas Fuji would basically just kind of, you know, destroy the parts and, you know, like, make them wholesale, whereas Kodak would actually try to remake new cameras with the old parts.
Now, you said earlier that you could still find some of these cameras, perhaps on eBay or in a drugstore. I'm guessing that the cell phone camera has basically killed off this industry, or maybe not killed it off, but put it on life support. How viable, if at all, is this industry still?
I think it's about as viable as Kodak is in 2018. one thing I'll point out about Kodak is, earlier this year, they kind of drew a lot of attention for trying to sell a cryptocurrency miner. So I think that kind of tells you where Kodak is as a company in 2018. You can still buy these cameras. You know, they still sell them, and Fuji is in better shape than Kodak is. So, you know, like, they may be the better bet, but I will say that it's definitely something where, you know, when you can take an infinite number of photos and have them come out in better quality than you ever would with a disposable camera, even a 35 millimeter one, you know, there's not really much in the way of competition there.
Mm. Ernie, it's always fascinating to hear some of the topics you write about on your newsletter called Tedium. The one thing is that is never tedious is reading Tedium. I thank you once again for being on the program with us. Always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
Ernie Smith, writer of the website and newsletter Tedium. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0468, and you'll find links to Ernie's site. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Yosemite National Park in California is one of the most beautiful places on Earth. Recently, wildfires filled Yosemite with smoke, but fortunately, fire can't destroy the granite cliffs that attract tourists from around the world. The park is also home to one of the world's most beautiful hotels, the Ahwahnee. Built in 1927, the hotel has survived every fire and calamity over the decades. Until now, that is. Oh, the hotel's still there, but not the famous Ahwahnee name. You see, the company hired by the federal government to run the hotel 25 years ago lost its contract, and it's suing the United States now, saying it owns a trademark on the name Ahwahnee. Let's be fair. The National Park Service says the name was never part of the deal with the company. But until the lawsuit is resolved, the historic hotel where Queen Elizabeth and John F. Kennedy once stayed now has to give up its beloved name. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of The Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And here he is, once again, all laughed out, Stuart Nauman. Hi, Stu.
Hi, Peter. There. I had one little laugh, just a squeak out of there, like that last piece of toothpaste out of the tube.
Right.
There you go. There you go. Yeah, it was fun just for last festival, and I got a lot of laughs. 22 shows in 17 days, Peter.
Not bad.
Yeah, which is, for me, is a norm. It's the norm. But on this week on Book Banter, I'm going to talk about one comedian who was at Just for Laughs. She hosted a gala, and she was presented. They have an award show every year. She was presented with the Comedy Person of the Year Award by Kevin Hart, and he was there to present it. And he praised Tiffany Haddish, that's her name, Tiffany Haddish, for all that she has accomplished and what she's about to accomplish after a long, tough road to success as a comedian, which he believes has made a lot of her fellow women comics quite proud of her. Now, after a rough upbringing in one of the poorest neighborhoods of South Central Los Angeles, Haddish believes that getting into the world of comedy and associating herself with other comics like Hart and Joe Coy, whom she regarded like dear friends as well as peers, it just basically saved her life. And from there, Haddish has become one of the hottest comics around today with appearances on The Carmichael Show, Def Comedy Jam, Girls Trip, and her own comedy special entitled She Ready. And to find out how she traveled that difficult road to such comedy stardom, it's all explained in unabashed detail in her best-selling memoir, The Last Black Unicorn. Now, when you read this book, you get the feeling that Haddish's upbringing was Dickensian in nature, at the very least. Her father abandoned the family when she was young. Her mother survived a horrendous car accident that left her with severe brain damage. She spent time in a foster care facility when her grandmother wasn't able to look after Haddish and her siblings. And she went through a series of relationships that were dysfunctional at best. But what makes this book such an enjoyable read, and at times will make you laugh out so loud you will have to put the book down for a few minutes just to catch your breath, is Haddish's tendency to liberally pepper the text with word-for-word dialogue that fleshes out the incidents and stories that basically make up her life, which could be the premise for a future solo show or a movie by Spike Lee or Tyler Perry, or a semi-autobiographical biopic in the same vein as Richard Pryor's JoJo Dancer, Your Life is Calling. The dialogues are quite pointed and explicit, many of which cannot be, you know, when I wrote this review for the Montreal Times, I couldn't even reprint it, or let alone quote it on air. Maybe there's one I could quote that's, you know, that doesn't have any foul language in it. But it gives an honest portrayal of the anger and fighting, that, you know, spirit that makes up the character of Tiffany Haddish. Now, I'll just say just one quick quote, one quick dialogue when she was at the foster care facility, in which she was constantly bullied by fellow residents. One bully girl said to her, "You funny looking, do anybody ever do your hair?" And she goes, "No, I got Raggedy Ann hair. This hair, you can't comb it. It breaks combs."
Hmm. You mentioned Kevin Hart giving her an award at Just for Laughs. Does it mention anything about the fact that Kevin Hart also gave her some money so she wouldn't be living in her car?
Yes. Yes. And believe it or not, when she got the award and they were on stage together, she gave Kevin a little present, and it was a mini pair of Van shoes, you know, and in it had some cash in it. So as like a down payment as a bit of payback for the money that he gave her while she was, you know, during her days as a struggling comic.
And she's a wonderfully sweet woman. I have a piece of embroidery because she's a very handy, crafty kind of person. You know, she does embroidery and the like.
Oh, yeah?
And I have a piece of embroidery that says thank you and her signature in embroidery from when she was at Just for Laughs, the very first time she was here several years ago, when she was just one of the many acts that was working at Club Soda and I was working backstage. And it's hanging on my wall right now.
Well, that takes a lot of skill. She is a very multifaceted person, not just, you have to admit.
Not just a lot of skill, a very kind person to go to that trouble.
Well, you know, funny you should mention that, Peter, because after the award ceremony, she was meeting with people who were in the audience, taking pictures, posing for pictures, chatting with them. Even after where she went to the lobby of the Hyatt Hotel, and she was still talking with fans and posing for pictures. So that just is very... you know, quite emblematic of the, you know, generous giving nature that Tiffany Haddish has. I guess, in a way, sort of like as a payback to the people who helped her out. And, you know, she wants to help out people as well. So yeah. I think that's it's very rare in a superstar entertainer. You have to admit that.
And the book again is?
Well, it's called The Last Black Unicorn. And this is no fantasy. She's the real deal, ladies and gentlemen. It's by Tiffany Haddish. It's published by Gallery Books, and it's $35.
And what do you recommend in a similar genre?
Well, for brutally honest memoirs by well-known comedians, let me suggest Prior Convictions, which I think was published shortly before his death in 2005. And also, if you want a good, well-rounded history about the... black comedians scene in America, I must highly recommend Mel Watkins' On the Real Side. It covers the entire breadth of black comedians in America from the Chitlin circuit up until Richard Pryor and beyond. It's probably one of the most definitive books, and it must be in your comedy library, if nothing else. This is one book that you must have.
And again, this week's book is?
Called The Last Black Unicorn by Tiffany Haddish, published by Gallery Books. And it's $35.
And how can people find you, Mr. Nolman, sir?
Well, not right now, Just for Last Festival. That's over. But you can find me in the pages of the Montreal Times, printed every Saturday, or you can catch me online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
Well, you're welcome, Peter. I'm not the last leprechaun, so just please think. No, don't think that.
Okay. Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we still have an Idiot of the Day coming your way, plus a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. We start off with this one. A Lawrence, Massachusetts man is facing gun charges after brandishing a gun at a landscaper outside a fast food restaurant. Lawrence police were called to a Wendy's at about noon for a report of a man threatening another man with a gun. When police arrived at the restaurant, a landscaper told them while he was using a leaf blower, some grass clippings blew into the air onto a black Acura sedan. A man in that car then got into a verbal altercation with the landscaper and brandished a firearm that was tucked into his waistband. The car was located a few minutes later, and the driver, identified as 21-year-old Franklin Manuel Laras, was arrested. A firearm was found in his waistband. Franklin was arraigned in Lawrence District Court, charged with assault with a dangerous weapon and other firearm-related charges. It should also be noted that this guy had a list of priors, including parole violations. It also should be noted that right behind the Wendy's in question is the police station. After the landscaper called the cops, they just jogged over by foot. So clearly, Franklin is not a bright boy. Who's going to make sure his car stays clean while he's behind bars? Yeah. You know how we love our truck spills here on the Stuff File program, right? Here's the latest one. A truckload of boxes filled with frozen chicken nuggets spilled in a Tennessee town covering an intersection in mounds of nuggets following an accident involving a train and a tractor trailer. Newport resident Linda Whitson described the scene as chicken nuggets for blocks. The Coke County Emergency Management Agency says the refrigerated trailer was carrying a full load of Tyson chicken nuggets when the collision occurred. Officials say no injuries were reported. The intersection was shut down for several hours as crews cleaned up the mess. Well, this is the very definition of a total cluster cluck. But it doesn't answer the question of why did the chicken cross the road? I have to ask, are you one of those people who can't seem to keep it together when your mobile device isn't working? If so, I suggest you seek professional help, and soon. Here's a cautionary tale. A Raleigh, North Carolina man has been arrested and charged after police said he intentionally crashed a car through a Verizon store on Thursday night. Police said 74-year-old Charles Michael Hager has been charged with 6 counts of assault with a dangerous weapon and damage to property. It happened just after 8:30 p.m. and the store had been closed since 8. Police said Hager was upset because he couldn't get into the store. When officers arrived, they found that Hager had kicked the front door of the building, breaking the glass. He then drove his vehicle through the glass storefront. None of the 6 Verizon workers who were in the store at the time were hurt. Hager was transported to the Wake County Detention Center. Can you hear me now? I wonder who his first call was to when he was arrested. Luckily, the authorities offer up their own phone for such situations. And under the heading of nice try, police say a 19-year-old man flipped his car in Madison, Wisconsin, then fled the scene, removing some clothes and pretending to be a jogger unconnected to the wreck. The unidentified man made a lane change at the same time as another car. He overcorrected, hit the shoulder, and his car overturned. Police Chief Mike Colville said the suspect fled and removed some clothing. When officers caught up with him, he told them that he was an uninvolved jogger. Officers ticketed the man for failure to have control, hit and run, and operating after revocation. Police say tests show the man wasn't impaired. As I said, nice try, but seriously, what was this driver thinking? I mean, the car is registered to him, so if he just ran away from the wreck, wouldn't they be tracking him down anyway? He's not going to say it was stolen, is he? Not the brightest bulb. I could have made him the idiot of the day, but I didn't. But that moment is here, and it's now. It's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
24-year-old Christian Palacios of Thibodaux, Louisiana, called 911 to ask a question. Did he have any active warrants out for his arrest? Apparently the answer was no, but police had a question for him. Did he know the difference between an emergency and a non-emergency call to police? His answer was yes, so he was arrested, charged with misusing the 911 system, a misdemeanor. Now, why? Oh, why would you call 911 to ask if police are looking for you, especially when they're not? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0468. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0468. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Revolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been getting jiggy with Peter Anthony Holder and the Stuff File program, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. He's a bad mamma jamma, and after he spends some chill time in his crib, he'll be back to get down with his bad self. Word up.